Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today. I want to start by bringing you greetings from Janet. She asked me to let you know that she covets your prayers on hers and Martin's behalf. I think she's struggling probably more than Martin. Certainly her emotional state is one of feeling like her son needs her. And so she apologized that she wasn't here this morning, but we had the good news that they did finally remove the breathing apparatus. So he continues to improve, and she is very thankful for your prayers on her behalf and on his behalf. We all have to deal with difficult people. My wife married one. But seriously, when you're at work, in a store, even if you're the customer, and on the road when you get cut off. We all have to deal with difficult people. And probably at home, in close proximity, it's the hardest thing to deal with. So let's take a look today at how Jesus dealt with some difficult people and see if we can't derive some tools for us to use when we have to interact with difficult people. Our Bible reading this morning from Luke takes place early in Jesus' ministry. He hasn't really gotten too far in what he's doing, and yet there's already contention. It was never Jesus' goal to be contentious, but I think because of his idea and his radical reexamination of our relationship to God, it was inevitable that he was going to come into conflict. In chapter 4 of Luke's gospel, he's in the synagogue, and at first people are quite enamored of him, but then he takes them to task, and if you recall, they want to get rid of him, even at that point. They're so angry. There's a couple of healings. He heals a woman from a fever. He casts out demons. And the people are unsure about this guy. Chapter 5, there's the miraculous catch of fish. And then there's the paralytic. If you remember, his friends take him and lower him through the roof. And Jesus says something that really starts to rankle with people. He claims to forgive the man's sins. And they say, who can forgive sins except God? Well, yes, they're right. But they don't understand who he is. And then at the conclusion of chapter 5, he's accused of eating with sinners. So there's already people who don't like what he's doing. Which leads to our first reading. Jesus is going to be confronted by difficult people over a core Jewish institution, the Sabbath. And this is not just couched in Moses' laws, this goes back to creation itself. One Sabbath, Jesus was going through the grain fields and his disciples began to pick some heads of grain, rub them in their hands, and eat the kernels. Some of the Pharisees asked, why are you doing what is unlawful on the Sabbath? And Jesus answered, have you never read what David did when he and his companions were hungry? He entered the house of God and taking the consecrated bread, he ate what is lawful only for the priest to eat. And he also gave some to his companions. Then Jesus said to them, the Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath. So they're going through the fields, they're picking grain. This isn't stealing. In Deuteronomy, the 23rd chapter, we read, when you go into the ripe grain fields of your neighbor, you may pluck off the kernels with your hand, but you must not use a sickle on your neighbor's ripe grain. So it's okay to go and take a little bit for your needs. But the minute you get your John Deere out and start combining, that's stealing. Luke points out that as they picked them, they rubbed them in their hands. It's almost as if the Pharisees saw that as work. And of course, you couldn't do work on a Sabbath. So our difficult people, these Pharisees, you remember them. They're zealous for God, but in a rigid kind of way. We think of them as right-facing. But I think we should be careful not to look down on them and their misunderstanding too much. Imagine yourself standing in a line of people as far to both sides as you can see. And you turn to your right. This is my right, it's your left, sorry. And you see all these other people who have a more conservative view of the world. And you probably expect to see Doug Ford out there somewhere on that right-hand end. And then you turn to your left, and you see all these people out there, including Justin Trudeau. And to those people, you look like you're the one on the right. You look like you're the one who's less liberal, who's more conservative, who's more rigid. We like to think of ourselves as being, you know, kind of in the middle and accepting. But we shouldn't be too quick to judge these Pharisees. They truly believed they were doing God's work. And we shouldn't be too quick to judge our neighbors either, who've never had a personal relationship with Jesus. So these people say to him, "Why are you?" And the "you" here is plural. Although if you read what Luke wrote, it said the disciples were eating. It never said Jesus was eating, but somehow he was responsible for them. "Why are you doing what is unlawful?" And Jesus responds in the way that God always responds. Need always trumps tradition. And he gives them the example. "Don't you remember when David needed something? He went and took the holy bread that was consecrated." This was a precedent for Jesus of what could be done under these situations. Jesus is saying, "My disciples are holy, just like that bread was set aside." The bread was actually baked one day and put out on display. It was given to the Lord, and it sat there. But after it was taken down, then and only then were the priests allowed to eat from it. But it was set aside with a special purpose. Jesus is saying, these men are set aside with a special purpose. Matthew's version says, the priests desecrated the Sabbath by eating that. But God wants mercy and not sacrifice. Jesus says, I'm above the Sabbath. Mark reminds us in the same passage that the Sabbath was made for man and not the other way around. I think there's a whole sermon series there. When Jesus was at creation and the Sabbath was created, he was already Lord of everything. He triumphs over the Sabbath. The first lesson that we need to understand when we're dealing with difficult people is God wants mercy and not sacrifice. It's an understanding of grace. Again, Matthew's version reminds us, if you'd really understood what was meant by this very familiar passage in Hosea, you wouldn't condemn the innocent. In dealing with people, mercy has to be at the top of our list. The Pharisees, they sought to honor God, all right, but by keeping rules. To them, that was their sacrifice. After all, weren't they now striving with this man who they thought was encouraging his friends to break the law? It was their honor and their privilege to do that. But they didn't understand who he really was. I'm going to introduce a word. The word is temper. Not that you should have one, but that you should have it. You've probably seen on the corner of your windshield, there's a little sticker that says, or a little incise that says, tempered glass. Tempered glass has been put under pressure. Its outside has become toughened to protect the more fragile part inside. Likewise, mercy has to be balanced by a knowledge of who you are. That's tempering. Then, and you can bestow grace. Jesus stands alone as Lord and Creator, but we mustn't forget that we too are God's children, and we have a standing and a place in God's house. First lesson, grace. On another Sabbath, he went into the synagogue and was teaching, and a man was there whose right hand was shriveled. The Pharisees and the teachers of the law were looking for a reason to accuse Jesus, so they watched him closely to see if he would heal on the Sabbath. But Jesus knew what they were thinking and said to the man with the shriveled hand, "Get up and stand in front of everyone." So he got up and stood there. Then Jesus said to them, "I ask you, which is lawful on the Sabbath, to do good or to do evil? To save life or destroy it?" He looked around at them all and then said to the man, "Stretch out your hand." He did so, and his hand was completely restored. But the Pharisees and teachers of the law were furious and began to discuss with one another what they might do to Jesus. This time, we're told forthrightly, these people were looking for a way to find accusation against Jesus. In our vernacular, we'd say they had it out for him. And the Pharisees were joined this time by another group. The word can be translated as scribes. I think the NIV gets a little closer when it calls them teachers of the law, and a translation that I like to use calls them experts in the law. In other words, the Pharisees had brought in ringers. We've seen that word scribe, and we might think that it's somebody who just did the work of copying things, but that couldn't be farther from the truth. These were not the guys in the mailroom making photocopies. They were willing to use their best guns to catch Jesus in breaking the law. It says they watched him closely in some translation. Some translations say spied. And I looked it up, and there was a translation from the Greek that used the word assiduously, which I had to look up. That word means with relentless attention and patience. This wasn't by accident. They set out to catch Jesus. And we have to give them some credit. Their tradition did allow that healing could happen on the Sabbath, but only if a life was threatened. And here we have this man who has a deformed hand. That's more an inconvenience than life-threatening, isn't it? So they're going to use this. I don't know if it's significant that Luke records that it was his right hand. Any southpaws out there? Raise your hand. Raise your left hand. Oh, quite a few over on this side. Oh, one or two over here. That's more than usual, actually. For most of us, though, our right hand is our stronger hand, isn't it? This man had just one usable hand for who knows how long. And the people out to get Jesus saw him not as a man, but as a tool to trap Jesus. They didn't want to see him be whole. They wanted to trap Jesus. But Jesus knew their hearts. John records for us that Jesus knows what is in a man. So he asks, and I imagine him standing appealing to the large crowd, which is right? to do good on the Sabbath, like he planned to do, or to plot evil, as these Pharisees and leaders of the people were? To save a life or destroy one? He knew full well they were out to destroy his life. Was he saving this man's life? No, maybe not. But he was making it new. He was giving him a new chance. He was replacing the old and broken with wholeness. And that's a physical foretaste of the spiritual wholeness that he wanted to do with their hearts. And then there's their reaction. They were furious. I don't think the NIV completely gets it, the translation there. The word that's used in the Greek implies complete loss of control. Other translations called it mindless fury, or the description that I like best, beside themselves with rage. Wow, that's anger. I'm reminded of little children who haven't been able to learn to control their emotions and are just so angry about something. This is how they were. All they can do is try to figure out what can we do to get rid of Jesus and his influence. So what do we learn from this confrontation? Well, we learn about saying and doing what is right. Truth. In the face of extreme opposition, Jesus stood fast. In fact, he challenged them right back. What do you think is right? Jesus was a provocative man. There's no doubt about that. And I don't think he had a problem with their oral tradition, the things they added to the law. I don't think he had a problem with that idea, unless it obscured the principles that God was trying to lay down. Until it became more important to follow their traditions than the truth that God was trying to reveal. And until it divided rather than uniting people. And that brings us to what I consider the theme verse that we're using today. The Word became flesh and made his dwelling among us. We have seen his glory, the glory of the one and only Son, who came from the Father, full of grace and truth. Remember our two situations? Mercy, not sacrifice. That embodies grace. Doing and saying what's right. That embodies truth. The one and only Son who came from the Father, full of grace and truth. So when we're dealing with difficult people, well, unlike Jesus, we can have problems with that sometimes. We don't always know how to demonstrate grace and truth. But our Master did, and he wants us to try and emulate him. Can I have the next slide, please? See if this is going to work today. There we go. Let's draw a line. We'll call it grace. On one end of the spectrum, we can withhold grace. Or we can withhold the mouse. Can you hit the next one? It's not. I am using the trigger. Oh, got it that time. Technology keeps me at a job. On the other end of the spectrum, we can project grace. And if we draw a vertical, on one end of the spectrum, we can withhold truth, and on the other, we can project truth. And that kind of divides things into four quadrants. First, we can have the people who project truth but withhold grace when faced with difficult people. This kind of reaction says, I need to win. It's coercive. It's polarizing. If we follow that, we're a bully. Next, we could withhold truth and withhold grace. This kind of reaction says, let's just sweep it under the rug. All the time, the problem is still simmering in the background, isn't it? It's a ceasefire, but it doesn't really solve anything. There's an air of niceties, but everything's building up until there's an explosion. And we're likely to retaliate. We can project grace, but withhold truth. In that situation, we give up on ourselves, and we give up on what is right for the sake and appearance of calm. Again, it never addresses the conflict. It says, let's be pals. And if we do that, then we're just enabling bad behavior. Well, obviously, the final quadrant is where we want to be because it follows what Jesus shows us. He projects grace and truth. This is Jesus' way. It deals with the concern, but always with mercy. And most importantly, it marks us as his followers. And that's the way of love. We've seen how Jesus dealt with difficult people and people with an agenda to harm him. I have two lessons for us to learn from this. First of all, know who you are. You're a child of God. You're known by him. You've been loved for all eternity before you were ever growing in your mother's womb. Jesus knew who he was because of his relationship to God. And so should you. This means you can project truth. And the second lesson is, know who you are. You're a sinner. You've fallen short. Of yourself, you're exactly what God can't abide. You're darkness to his light. But you've been bought back with a price. You're a child of grace. This means you know what it's like to be forgiven, and you can project grace to others. Did you catch that? Lesson one and lesson two are exactly the same. Lesson one, know who you are from above. Lesson two, know who you are from below. One tempers the other. One practical lesson we can learn from Jesus on this, ask questions. In our examples today, he asked questions that delve deep to all the principles that we share. Too often when we deal with difficult people, we want to fix what we perceive as wrong. Asking questions moves us away from the conflict and into the realm of what truth is. It lets the other person examine themselves and affords us the opportunity for grace. As the Bible says in 1 Peter 4 and verse 8, love covers over a multitude of sins. Know that you are loved by God, and you can project grace and truth and love others.
Thanks for listening to this week's sermon. The Beamsville Church of Christ meets Sunday mornings at 4900 John Street, Beamsville, Ontario. We have classes for all ages at 9:30, and the worship service begins at 10:30. You can subscribe to podcasts through Apple Podcasts, Google Play Music Store, or your favorite podcast app. Just search for Beamsville. All our past sermons and more information about our congregation are available at beamsvillechurchofchrist.ca.